Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Chef Sean Sherman calls himself the sous chef. He put together an ancient pantry based on pre-reservation foods and flavors.
I knew there was a large base of what wild plants were used for, wild roots were used for, so it just set me on a long path of research. Lots of ethnobotany books, a lot of history pieces looking for first contact accounts of Europeans, and unfortunately a lot of times they would just talk about what men were doing and didn't really break down how the women were processing everything, and that was the really important part. Because as a chef, I was just really looking for food and flavor and technique. And, you know, there's luckily a few accounts here and there, some really good volumes and books. So it's kind of like taking a big broken pot and slowly putting it back together piece by piece until I could see a bigger image of the whole thing.
The sous chef and the questionable future of almonds, this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Almonds are good for us. Health studies tell us so, and that's the good news. The bad news is it takes 1 gallon of water to grow one almond. That's a single nut. And that's especially bad news since 80% of the world's almonds are grown in California, and California is in the midst of the mother of all droughts. Not what you'd call a sustainable situation. Add to the mix money. California almonds make at least $4.8 billion a year. Well, one in-depth look at this almond dichotomy is an article by journalist Tom Philpott in Mother Jones. Tom, good to have you with us.
It's great to be here.
This is my question. Nearly every food crop in California is in trouble with this drought. For instance, one walnut takes nearly 5 gallons of water. So why the focus on almonds?
The focus on almonds is because the vast expanse of almonds that are in California, it is a huge crop, way bigger than walnuts, way bigger than pistachios. And when you add it all up, almonds take more total water than any other crop. And the other thing is, if you think about lettuce, if there's a drought on, you can not plant lettuce that year, or you can cut back on your plantings of lettuce, and so you use less water. But if you have a massive plantation of almonds, you can't simply not water them. And so it raises demand, and it keeps it steady and rising even when there's a drought. And that's the main problem.
So how much money does an acre of almonds pay me if I'm a farmer?
My understanding is that you're talking about $5,000 per acre in revenue. Now, that doesn't account for costs, but $5,000 an acre is a lot of money when you multiply it out. Some of these entities own 20, 30,000 acres. So you're talking about in the hundreds of millions of dollars.
Oh, yeah. And I read something about the fact that between 2013 and 2014, 48,000 more acres have been put to growing almonds. So this is a lot of money. But isn't it in the best interest of the growers to figure out every way possible to save water? Because otherwise, eventually, this is just going to stop dead. There is not going to be any almond crop.
Yeah, that's very true. But you got two things going on here. One is you've got this common resource. These reserves of water underground are a common resource. And if your neighbor is down there with a giant straw sucking it away, then you want to get your straw in there, too. The second thing is that, you know, I figured that about 70% of the almond growers in California are family farms. Mm-hmm. So it isn't just corporations that are growing almonds. But I also found this influx of money from large investment funds, from hedge funds, from insurance companies that are coming in and buying the land as an investment. And it's very attractive to them because California is in a farmland boom. Land prices keep going up. And then you get this wonderful income of $5,000 an acre off of it. And so their time horizon on their investment might be 10 or 15 years, where they're thinking, let's keep this land for 10 or 15 years. Let's make this income off of the almonds or whatever crop we have on it, and then we'll sell it. Whereas a family farm also has this interest in getting their, you know, their straw in the Kool-Aid before it runs dry, but they're also thinking about the long-term health of the land. They're thinking about their kids. They're thinking about further generations, whereas these companies are, you know, thinking in a much shorter time frame.
Is there any way to grow almonds in California that's sustainable?
Well, sure. I mean, the thing about California is that it is really the Central Valley of California is an almond growing paradise. You've got these long, dry summers. You've got these winters that are relatively warm where it rarely, if ever, freezes. And California has this incredible infrastructure of capturing snowmelt from the Sierra Nevadas and bringing it down to the farms, and this incredible, these viaducts and, you know, this massive infrastructure that was built in the 20th century. But the question is, can it continue expanding at the rate that it is now? And I think that at the current rate, I don't think there's any sustainable way to grow almonds. It can't go on for very much longer. I think that as much work as they've put in to make almonds water efficient, they're growing so many of them that I think they've expanded beyond California's water resources. Mm-hmm. So I think we'll see a pulling back of them. I don't think we'll see the end of almonds.
And all this is happening while almonds are becoming more popular than ever.
Right. Almonds passed peanuts in the past couple of years as the most popular American nut. And almond consumption here in the United States has more than doubled in the past couple of years. And in China, in the past 5 years, it has quadrupled. So you're seeing this surge in popularity.
So who controls or regulates water usage in California?
Aha, that's a great question. So there's two kinds of water in California. There's groundwater and there's surface water. And the surface water is highly regulated. This is the stuff that comes off the Sierra Nevada mountains and goes through these viaducts and whatnot. Certain places have strong water rights. Other places have lesser water rights. It's a big constant battle, but there's nothing more regulated than California's surface water. Groundwater is basically the Wild West. Right now, if you own a piece of land in almost any county in California, you can drop as big of a well as you want. And so there's this sort of Wild West mentality where everyone's just pumping water like crazy. And it's kind of a fossil resource. It takes hundreds and thousands of years of water dripping down into the soil beneath the rocks to get into these aquifers. And we're sucking it dry like it's nothing. And in my piece, I talk about how living off the surface water from the snowmelt is sort of like living off of income. But living off of the groundwater in the aquifer is like living off of savings. And so it should be used very carefully. And right now, it's not being used carefully at all, I'm afraid. But in the end of 2014, the legislature finally did something about it. After years and years and years of talking about it, they put together a law that is going to force every watershed to come up with a policy on its own to rationally regulate this. But first of all, it's very far off. It doesn't kick in for several years, and it gradually kicks in. And second of all, there's a lot of concern that the big landowners who own the most land are going to sort of work the system and still be able to get as much water as they want.
You know, in looking at all of this material about the amount of water it takes to grow all of these things, you know, the broccoli, the lettuce, the tomatoes, the almonds, the walnuts, you look at the produce section with completely different eyes.
Yeah, that's true. If you think about it, what you're doing when you buy produce is you're buying water. And, you know, so much of our produce comes from California, and so much of that produce is based on this incredible infrastructure that California built up in the 20th century. And the thing that I'm concerned about is that if you look at the fossil record, it looks like California is going to have less water going forward than it had in the 20th century. And then you add climate change to that, and you get less precipitation, you get less snow to pack the mountains in the winter, and you're looking at a situation where California is going to have less water, and I'm wondering where the vegetable is going to come from. And what I think is going to happen is vegetable production is going to spread out. We're not going to have it as much concentrated in California, which I think is a good thing down the road. I mean, it's part of the local food movement. Part of the goal of that was to spread it out, and I think that this drought in California and this sort of oversubscription of the water supplies there is going to be a lever to increase interest in growing vegetables in places like Minnesota, even in the summer.
Tom, thank you so much for talking about this with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Food and Wine magazine named Tom Philpott one of the innovators who will shape our culinary consciousness over the next 30 years. Tom's article, California Goes Nuts, appeared in Mother Jones and has been nominated for a James Beard Award. Jane and Michael Stern have been writing about local eating since the 1970s, starting with their first book, Road Food, an idea I wish I had had, by the way. And with more than 30 books between them and a website, roadfood.com, they keep us all up to date on what and where to eat in America. Jane, Michael, great to have you two back.
Hi, Lynn.
Lynn, we have eaten a very interesting food. It's called the Zep, and we had it in Norristown, Pennsylvania. Now, being an expert in Italian cuisine, as we all know you are, what do you think a Zep is?
Well, there is the feast in September that I can't remember that happens in New York, and it's, you know, a saint's day. And there is a fried donut called a Zeppole. It is the kind of thing that when it lands on your tummy, you'll never forget it, and it will be with you for a while. But they are addictively good.
That's what I thought a Zep was also. In New England, they simply call it fried dough. But in Norristown, Pennsylvania, a Zep is a type of grinder.
Or hero sandwich.
And there's been a debate about, is this named after a Zeppole or a Zeppelin?
Well, it looks more like a Zeppelin than it looks like a Zeppole.
So the airship, the big cigar-shaped
airship.
It looks like
an airship, exactly, yeah. like a submarine sandwich looks like a submarine. But regardless of how it got its name, a Zep, it's unique to Norristown, and it very much resembles the standard Delaware Valley hoagie, which is the great place for hoagies in the Delaware Valley. But it differs in at least a couple of significant ways. In Norristown, when you order a Zep, it will never have lettuce on it, the way many hoagies do. And it will always have several thick slices of raw onion. That is intrinsic to the nature of a Zep.
Okay, but when I think of a hoagie or a submarine or whatever, I think of a lot of different kinds of salami and mortadella, you know, cold cuts, and then all kinds of, you know, olive relish and whatever. Is that what this sandwich is about?
There are many variations of a Zep. I mean, the classic Zep is provolone, salami, onions, tomatoes, plenty of olive oil and oregano. Mm. Some people say it must, forget the salami, it must have cotto salami, you know, the kind of bologna-like salami.
Yeah, right, right.
Otherwise, you know, there are tuna Zeps, there are all kinds of different cold cut Zeps. But the one thing, besides the onion and the lack of lettuce, the one thing that is essential for a Zep is that it must be made on a roll from Conshohocken Bakery in Conshohocken. These rolls are, they're not like a po' boy roll in Louisiana. They're not like a French bread. They're much chewier. They're very substantial. They're the kind of roll that will hold massive amounts of ingredients and never disintegrate.
Kind of sourdough-ish.
Almost like sourdough. I mean, really kind of dense and chewy and substantial and big flavor the way sourdough can be.
So is this sort of a cult food in that part of the world?
It is. I mean, there are maybe, we know of three different places in Norristown that serve it. There are probably more, but we've never seen a Zep anywhere else.
I would love to draw a map of the United States once with the different types of hoagies, heroes, submarines, po-boys, whatever
grinders,
on it.
Wedges.
Because I swear if you go 20 miles in any direction from anywhere, you're going to get into another type and version of this meat on a big, crusty loaf. Although this is the only one I've ever seen without lettuce.
That's interesting that you say that because, you know, there is that idea that the world is really all separated by what people eat and the versions
totally
of what they eat.
Our world certainly is.
And I love it. I love it when you two do anthropology. I just think it's so fascinating. So if we want a Zep, we go to Norristown, Pennsylvania.
It's the only place.
Okay. And if we want a hoagie?
Well, then you go to the White House sub shop in Atlantic City.
I understand. Okay, now we know where the road trip is going.
Where you can get lettuce.
Ah, okay.
Guys, great news. Thank you.
Bye-bye, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
Jane and Michael Stern are the creators of roadfood.com. Now, you can find all their dining suggestions as well as past interviews at splendidtable.org. And while you're there visiting, be sure to register for this month's giveaway. It's the last week to get registered for some good knives, you know, the kind that you can pass on to your grandkids. A three-piece pro knife set from Zwilling J.A. Henkels. Get the details at splendidtable.org. Coming up, a monk and an endangered cheese. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media.
Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. In every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking an amazing meal. Listen as Ina does what she does best, make good conversation and delicious food, while making it sound fun and easy. This season, Ina dives into conversation with astronaut and colonel Nicole Mann. As Ina teaches Nicole how to make seared scallops with celery root puree, they talk about everything from family to what foods Nicole really craves when she's in space. And listen in as Ina and Pulitzer Prize-winning writer David Remnick talk about music lessons and the value of developing language skills before joining their spouses for a lively conversation over a comforting dish of chicken parmesan. If you love a good chat over a great meal, you'll love Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Almost a century ago, in rural Manitoba, a group of monks in the monastery Notre Dame des Prairies were given a recipe for a traditional cheese that they could make and sell to help support their home. Well, they've been making that cheese, Fromage de la Trappe, for years and selling it locally. But that market has gotten tougher, and today there's only one monk left making that cheese. Its future is uncertain. Well, producer Max Layton visited the monastery and the man who is the last cheesemaker.
It's a cold winter day. I'm walking up a gravel road just outside Holland, Manitoba, a small town in the Canadian prairies about 50 miles from the North Dakota border. It's quiet and remote, a good place to keep to yourself. From the road, you can see the bells of the monastery of Notre Dame de Prairie just over the treetops. It's home to a small group of Trappist monks, keepers of a traditional recipe for a gourmet cheese called Fromage de la Trappe. It's sold only in a handful of shops in Manitoba. These days, it's made by just one man, and I've come to meet him.
My name is Brother Alberic, A-L-B-E-R-I-C.
Alberic became a monk in his home province of Quebec at the age of 16. He's 80 now, but moves purposefully, and he can be hard to keep up with. If you squint, he looks a little bit like Robert De Niro. He says many of the monks at Notre Dame de Prairie have lived into their 90s, a product, he says, of their vegetarianism and the steady rhythm of life there.
The Trappist life is the contemplative life. Our life is split between prayers, working, and parts of the reading and personal prayer or study.
And for a few hours each morning, making cheese. Alberic's cheese factory looks more like a suburban bungalow tucked away behind the monastery.
So this is the factory. Oh, it smells great in here.
You smell cheese?
Yeah, that's the cheese, eh?
Fromage de la Trappe is a nutty, slightly salty washed rind cheese. Making it requires patience and observation, but the cooking process is pretty straightforward. He mixes rennet into a frothing vat of milk, and in a few minutes dips his pinky finger in to test for thickness. When he's satisfied, he cuts the curds with a tool that looks like a stainless steel fly swatter and scoops them out to drain. Then he puts them into molds and onto presses to sit until evening. Alberic says much of the flavor comes from the raw milk he uses, a controversial ingredient these days. But without it, he says,
right away you lose all the taste, all the flavor, all the smell. That's why so many sheep don't taste nothing. You see, the feed of the cattle and everything has an influence on the milk, and the milk has an influence on the cheese. You see, you don't play with that.
The magic happens in the cellar. It's down a flight of wooden stairs below the kitchen. It has a medieval feel to it, damp and dim, with long rows of wooden shelves. And on each, wheels and wheels of cheese. From pale and gelatinous newcomers to taut, golden, pungent wheels which have ripened for 2 months and are nearly ready for their second coming on Earth. Down here, time, temperature, humidity, and microbes do much of the work. And Alberic helps them along, methodically wiping each wheel in brine and flipping them over once a day.
Is a monkey work, you know, you just wash the cheese and turn the cheese, wash the cheese. When you have 400 or 500 to wash, you know, the head turned with the cheese.
Pacing the cellar alongside Alberic, it's easy to imagine you've stepped back a few centuries. In fact, he claims his recipe came to Canada around the turn of the last century with a French monk named Brother Alphonse Jouin, who carried it across the ocean to Oka, Quebec. Alberic says that same recipe was originally given to the monks of Manitoba as a Christmas gift in 1918. He says he got his hands on it years later when the monastery needed some extra cash.
The superior asked me, says, I want to talk to you. And he gave me an envelope. He says, keep this because you will need this later on. And when I came and by this, I look at that was the recipe of the cheese that we received in 1918. 1985, I says, I have the recipe. Why we don't start the cheese?
Brother Alphonse Jouin's Oka cheese is still made in Quebec today by a large dairy co-op, who deny Alberic's claims to a shared history between their cheeses. And soon, it may not matter much anyway, because Manitoba's cheese-making monk has not arranged for a successor. There's been some business interest, but so far, no one has been able to make it work. Alberic has had young protégés as well, but no one has stayed. A recent helper showed promise, but he found another calling.
He's married now. Is that common?
Oh, yeah. They come, but you see, the same thing when a boy met a girl, that doesn't mean you will marry her. But they come here to experiment if that fit with their life. He had been with us 2-3 years. He says, God called me here and I will see you all my life. But a few months after he was gone, and a few months after that, he was married.
C'est la vie.
C'est la vie, sûr, c'est la vie.
Is there anyone else?
No. So far, no. I would like somebody to be able to give that. Doesn't matter if it's outside of the other. Because the value of the cheese is something. Because lots of people like that cheese. We sell lots now. And we have more demand than we can supply now.
Like many religious communities in Canada, Notre-Dame-de-Prairie has seen its numbers dwindle over the decades. At afternoon prayer, there are just a few elderly brothers gathered to sing and pray under the vaulted arches of the chapel. Around here, this is a vanishing way of life, and if it disappears, traditions that span centuries may go with it, like Alberic's cheese. That is, unless somebody takes the time to learn.
That cheese is Fromage de la Trappe by Brother Alberic at the Notre-Dame-de-Prairie Monastery in Manitoba, Canada. Max Layton is an independent producer living in Winnipeg, Manitoba. Sean Sherman is one part chef, one part sleuth. He trained extensively in restaurant kitchens, but he was born Oglala Lakota, on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. And with all his chef's training, he discovered little about his own culinary heritage, the foods of his people cooked before the Europeans came. Probably because, until fairly recently, the cuisines of the original Americans were seen as irrelevant. Pretty startling when you think about it. But Sean became a plains forager, a far-reaching researcher, and a very different sort of cook. Producer Jennifer Russell invited Sean into the studio to get his story.
Thanks for coming in today. It's nice to have you.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
So, Sean, how do you define your food?
Well, I am specializing in Native American food, but particularly I'm specializing in the Dakota and the Ojibwe food from this region, even though I grew up on Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, so I'm Lakota, but I wanted to really focus on the regionality of it. So since my business is here in Minnesota, I wanted to focus on just Dakota and Ojibwe. You know, I started cooking at a really young age. After I moved off the reservation, I moved to the Black Hills, and I started working in tourist restaurants when I had barely just turned 13. So I've been in the restaurants for quite a few years, because I'll be 41 here in a little bit. So it's definitely a lot of time in the kitchen, and it has become a passion, of course, over the past quite a few years.
So can you talk a bit about Native American or indigenous foods, specifically sort of pre-reservation?
Yep. So when I came out, I was kind of focusing on pre-reservation foods, meaning I wanted to know about all the food systems that people were utilizing in this region, because obviously people had survived here for thousands of years and there was lots of great food, and it's obvious with all the food that's in the forest and the lakes and everything. You know, the proteins and the meats were easy because it's just the wild animals were out there. For me, it was a longer study in ethnobotany, basically, what plants were indigenous and growing around here, how Native American people were utilizing things, understanding Native American farming and agriculture, because that was such a huge scene, especially in this region, and understanding how food preservation systems were working for people to maintain and keep a lot of food in their food caches to last them through the long winters. So for me, it was basing my food, my pantry items, based on those pieces, the dried corns, the dried beans, the dried wild rice, of course, and all the varieties of all of that, you know, when they're making things into meal and powder, all the different dried vegetables that were utilized. So those were like the base flavors for me to really think about using in this region. And it really shows how regional and diverse the United States is, because all these micro regions of Native American cultures had different food systems slightly. So it's even different from Dakota down here to Ojibwe in the north, or to the Lakota where I grew up. And it's definitely diverse completely across the board if you start looking at other regions.
So how did you learn about and gather all of this information about these pre-colonization diets and ingredients? It wasn't like there were a lot of written records, I would imagine. How did you go about that?
Yep. When I first started researching, you know, I found there was very little information. I had kind of cross-studied Asian food systems a little bit. And I realized if you're studying like Eastern medicine, just how medicine and food is all combined. And it was really the same way that Native Americans were looking at their food basis too, because all this food was medicine also. It had different properties for different pieces. So I knew there was a large base of what wild plants were used for, wild roots were used for, and I just kind of wanted to search for that. So it just set me on a long path of research, you know, for quite a few years. So reading through lots of ethnobotany books about the plants and indigenous plants of these regions, a lot of history pieces looking for first contact accounts of Europeans of what they're seeing. And unfortunately, a lot of times they would just talk about what men were doing and didn't really break down how the women were, you know, processing everything, and that was the really important part. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's luckily a few accounts here and there, some really good volumes and books that really kind of had a big window for me to look at, you know, because as a chef, I was just really looking for food and flavor and technique. So slowly piecing it together. So it's kind of like taking a big broken pot and slowly putting it back together piece by piece until I could see a bigger image of the whole thing. And, you know, I'm still learning a lot as I move forward with it, of course.
So what did you discover about the foods they were growing and gathering on the Great Plains at that time?
So there's many varieties of corn that were being grown. There's many varieties of beans, be it fresh beans to like dried black turtle beans, red beans, yellow beans, white beans. And there's lots of different varieties of squash, you know, things from zucchini to pumpkin, basically. And there's a whole bunch of these old heirloom varieties. And you find farms like around the cities today, like Wojupi or Dream Wild Health, who are slowly growing out some of these heirloom varieties that have been in these regions for a long time, so we can get them back into the food systems, and especially back onto hopefully some more traditional Native American tables. There was, you know, of course, like I said, the meats were easy because, you know, there's the venison, there's duck, there's bison, there's rabbit, you know, there was also squirrel and muskrat and things like that. All the river fish, you know, the walleye, the trout, whitefish, northerns. So there was quite a few options out there, and tons of flavors, and so much fruit and berries that grow, so many roots. You know, there's the wild potatoes, there's wild ginger, there's so much food around us. And I use a lot of tree food too. So I use a lot of cedar and fir tree and pine and spruce and things like that, not only for teas, but for also just seasoning. And, you know, so I modernize the food some, but I try to keep it really minimalist style in cooking. So I'm only using a few ingredients. So not using any of the processed sugar, no flour, no beef, pork, or chicken, and really trying to really stay true to a lot of the indigenous ingredients as much as possible. So I might add a few organic vegetable pieces here and there, but for the most part, you know, I'm probably hitting 95% indigenous options on the menus that I build.
That's really cool. You touched on it a little bit, but can you talk about the role of preservation in this Native American cuisine? It was huge.
Mm-hmm. And like during harvest season, especially around the farms, it would be a huge deal because they would just build these mass scaffolding just so they could, you know, sun dry all the corn and squash and things like that quite a ways above ground and have small fires set below. So you have heat coming from below and a little bit of smoke also. But, you know, sun drying and smoking was the best way to preserve. And it was such an important way because I was able to, you know, keep foods for quite a long time throughout the winter season, definitely. So if you read books like Buffalo Bird Woman's Garden, where she plots out how they built these old food caches and how they laid everything out, and that they would make quite a few of them, you know, to almost like one per month throughout the winter season to break into. So food preservation was extremely important.
Mm-hmm. So all of this has led to more than just cooking for you. What's next?
You know, I think my ultimate goal would be to help set up some kind of Native American training center. I can envision having a center almost like a cooking school that would teach people an education on Native American farming, foraging, preservation techniques, salt making processes, the different styles of cooking with fire and the different styles that people were traditionally cooking, you know, clay cooking, earth and oven cooking, styles and techniques like that. Of course, an education of just processing all the different kinds of foods that were being harvested, whether through agriculture or through foraging, and, you know, be able to give basically like a Native American cooking degree to students or do adult outreach education so people can come in and learn, and just helping bring a Native American food culture into the modern world.
Sean, it was a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Sean Sherman is the sous chef. Jennifer Russell is our producer. For more information on Sean and to get his recipe for wasabi, a traditional Native American berry dish, go to splendidtable.org. We're going to be back soon to talk to you. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media.
Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. In every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking an amazing meal. Listen as Ina does what she does best, make good conversation and delicious food, while making it sound fun and easy. This season, Ina dives into conversation with astronaut and colonel Nicole Mann. As Ina teaches Nicole how to make seared scallops with celery root puree, they talk about everything from family to what foods Nicole really craves when she's in space. And listen in as Ina and Pulitzer Prize-winning writer David Remnick talk about music lessons and the value of developing language skills before joining their spouses for a lively conversation over a comforting dish of chicken parmesan. If you love a good chat over a great meal, you'll love Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. It is time for us to connect. You can get to us on Facebook and Twitter, or you can call us, 800-537-5252. Matt is on the line. Matt, what do you want to talk about? By the way, where are you calling from?
Los Angeles, California. I am utterly confused about my popovers. I have this great recipe, and it's like a magic recipe. And my kids come and they turn on the oven and they stare inside because they know with Daddy's recipe that sometimes it's going to work and sometimes it isn't. And I have absolutely no understanding of why. I feel like I follow the thing absolutely to the letter every single time the same way. And yet sometimes I get these huge, puffy, beautiful popovers, and other times we get pop unders.
Which are very interesting.
They taste nice.
Yeah,
but
right, exactly.
They're not pillowy. They're just sort of
Let's quickly go over the recipe. Give me an idea of what you do, okay?
Okay. It's very simple. It's 2 cups of whole milk. It's 4 eggs. It's 2 cups of unbleached white flour and half a teaspoon of salt. And basically, the recipe calls for just pouring in the milk, putting in the eggs, whipping a little bit, putting in the salt, giving it another brief whisk, then putting in the flour, mix it till it's just mixed, you know, no lumps, and then basically taking tiny little pieces of butter as you warm up the muffin pan in the oven at 450. And then we take it out of the oven, we pour in halfway, and then throw it in at 450, and then after 15 minutes, reduce to 350.
Okay. First of all, are you using an oven thermometer?
We are not using an oven thermometer. But the oven is this mechanical gadgety thing that...
Yeah, I know, but you know what? They're evil beasts, ovens are, no matter how much you spend for them, no matter how fancy they are. Just to play it safe, tuck an oven thermometer in there.
Awesome.
Because it could be your oven goes off every so often, and it could be, too. Is it a gas or an electric oven?
It is an electric oven.
That's what I thought. Sometimes, I know this sounds very strange, but sometimes there's a draw on the power. So that you know, that could be something that you have no control over, but if you have that oven thermometer in there, because if you're preheating the oven too short a time, it could be the oven isn't hot enough when it goes in.
Okay.
So that's one thing, and that may solve the problem right there. The only other thing I can think of is perhaps beat up the egg and milk mixture more.
Really?
Yeah.
I would always thought, does that add more oxygen, or is it?
I think, yeah, but what it might do is it helps, you know, it creates oxygen bubbles that can expand as it's in the heat. But I really question your oven. I think that may be the hitch. Are there times when you, I mean, do you give it a full 20 minutes to a half hour to warm up?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Well, it tells me, so.
I understand. I understand. Look, put a thermometer in there just to make sure it's telling you the truth.
So it couldn't be the butter or anything, like how I'm pulling out the butter? Because
the pan has to be really hot. The muffin pan has to be really hot.
Okay. As you pour in the batter, the pan has to be?
It should be hot, yeah. Yeah, that's my understanding of it. Yeah. How have you been doing it in the past when it works?
Well, I feel like I do it the same, but maybe there's something different. And I feel like the only problem could be where I'm pulling the pans out, because they say put in the little pieces of butter, put it back into the oven to heat up, and then pull it out and pour in the batter. So maybe it's in the process of those two.
Maybe you're having it out of the oven too long.
Too long.
Yeah, because the trick is that batter has to hit a hot pan. That's what gives it the initial, you know, wham. And that high temperature is what's going to really make the puff happen. The lower temperature is what's going to cook the interior.
Interesting. Okay. Now,
and then there's another psychological piece to this. Explain to your kids that this is a great life lesson and that it's the old story of when you get flat popovers, you can still make wonderful things happen.
Oh, they're all
I mean, when in doubt, use psychology.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I always meant the souffle to be flat. It's a new idea.
Just teaching you.
Yeah, it's a moment. No, but I think check oven and make sure the pan's hot. And I think you're going to have the problem solved.
Thank you so much.
Hey, thank you, Matt. Thanks for the call. Right, bye. It is interesting, though. I mean, there are times when you really want that pan super hot. When you make cornbread in an iron skillet in the oven, you want that thing to be hot. Okay. Call us, 800-537-5252. You can get to us that way. And that's what Janet's done. She's calling from Georgia. Janet, where in Georgia are you?
Hi, Lynn. Well, I'm outside of Atlanta, about an hour north. We're in a little lake community called Cumming.
Oh, that sounds pretty.
Yeah, it is.
So what do you want to talk about?
I love your show, and my husband and I both love to cook. We eat a lot of fish, but it's typically grilled, but in pieces. And we were given a beautiful 3-pound North Georgia trout, but it's totally intact. It's been gutted. It's in the freezer. And I'd like to cook the whole thing, you know, with this interesting presentation. But it's gutted. But other than that, it's, I mean, it's got the tail. It's got the eyes.
I got the whole thing.
What do
thing.
I do with it? Yeah.
Well, what you're going to do with it, first of all, is since trout is so delicate and it's so delicious, I wouldn't do anything to overpower the taste.
Okay.
But a couple of ways you can go with this. And one way is because this keeps you from having to turn the fish, okay?
Okay.
Because it's delicate, is to do it in the oven, but to wrap it in parchment paper.
Okay.
And what you do is that you take the fish, slather it with whatever seasonings you want. And one of the things I like to do with trout is something like a little bit of butter or olive oil that I've blended with a bit of minced onion or fresh herbs or a little bit of both. And just kind of slather that over the inside and the outside of the fish.
Okay.
Salt it. And then you can stuff on the inside slices of orange.
Ooh.
Which is kind of a nice touch. And then put it on a piece of oil, a piece of parchment paper, okay? And you can get parchment paper in rolls, just the way you would buy, you know, plastic wrap.
Yeah, I've used it before. I've got it in my pantry.
Okay. Okay, so what you're going to do is you're going to oil that paper really nicely. And if you want to, you can put some greens under it because they'll cook too. And again, a little bit of garlic or something in the onion family if you want to.
Okay, what kind of greens?
You know, one of the things I think would really be wonderful with it is something like chopped up chard.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, just a little, not too much. Or you can do a bed of herbs. That's another thing you can do.
Okay.
Which could really be great. And then the only thing you have to do is wrap it in the paper. In so many words, make like a tent for it with the paper.
Okay.
And you can use staples. So you bring the paper up, and you want to have room for because it's going to steam a bit. And how thick is the trout?
Pretty thick.
I would measure it. Measure the thickness, and you figure about 10 minutes to the inch.
Okay.
Okay? And then when you bring it to the table, because be careful, it's going to steam, what you do is just lift it up, put it on a platter, bring it to the table, ask everybody to lean back a little, and then you just tear open this.
Okay.
You know, this bag, and it's going to be a bit puffy. And there you will have this trout that'll taste utterly pure.
Okay.
And now there's a variation on this that I love to do with things like whole trout, which is take a roasting pan, oil it, chop up basil, rosemary, thyme, scatter that, make a bed of herbs. And then maybe a bit of paper-thin sliced potatoes. I do them on a mandolin. And some onions, and salt and pepper, and a little bit of white wine on that, and then slather the trout with a bit of oil or butter, okay? And then lay the trout on that bed.
Ooh.
And then you roast it.
Okay, and this is not using the parchment paper.
No parchment paper. This is the other way of doing it.
The other,
Yeah, and I bring it to the table. I mean, I make sure everybody sees it in that roasting pan. And then lift it off the pan with two big spatulas and put it on a plate and then bring it out. And you can put fresh herbs all around it and lemon and that kind of thing. So two different ways of doing it.
Okay.
But
all right.
In both ways, you don't turn the fish.
Right. And then do you have any recommendations in terms of defrosting it? Just defrost it in the fridge for a day or two?
Yeah, defrost it in the refrigerator. Check it, you know, open up the package, check that it's defrosted all the way through. But don't leave it, you know, as soon as it's defrosted all the way through, you're going to cook it.
Okay.
Okay? And
okay.
It sounds delicious.
Ooh, sounds wonderful. Thank you so much.
You're going to enjoy this.
Okay.
Take care, Janet. Thanks for a great call.
Thank you, Lynn.
Bye. Remember, you can call us anytime, 800-537-5252, and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. We all know couples whose beliefs are like chalk and cheese. One's a Democrat, the other's a staunch Republican. One's a born-again Christian, the other's an atheist. Well, what about carnivores and vegetarians? The question here is, does love conquer all? Our contributor, Melissa Clark, whose own marriage has a divide on the culinary front, got together with chef Sarah Copeland to talk the nuts and bolts of living with a vegetarian.
Hi, Sarah. Welcome.
Thank you for having me, Melissa. It's great to be here.
So, Sarah, you're a trained professional chef, and your husband is a vegetarian. How do you guys negotiate the whole food thing? How do you feed each other?
Well, it's so interesting because when we met, actually, the very first meal we ever had together, we sat down and we were eating. And I didn't really realize it till later, but it was a vegetarian meal. We were eating all kinds of, like, labneh and hummus and baba ganoush and everything. And it really never came up. And then as we started dating and he said he was a vegetarian, I was like, wow, I cook a really good steak. That's going to be a bummer for you. You know, but I never, ever thought about changing his mind. I never thought what I do is better or more delicious or what he does is better or better for the planet or anything. I just thought, okay, he's a grown-up. I'm a grown-up. You know, this is the way he eats. This is the way I eat. So we'll just eat this other way together. But then my life kind of morphed and the way I eat kind of morphed more towards his.
So you started eating, you say 90% vegetarian?
I would say 90% vegetarian.
And that's because you wanted to, because you were more attracted to the way he was eating?
Right. And, you know, the thing is, I really realized, I mean, whenever I would go to a restaurant, I would go, you know, obviously in our profession, sometimes you get a tasting menu and you get to have anything you want on the menu. And I was really gravitating always towards the vegetables, or it was sort of like everything around the meat was the most interesting to me. But I never really thought, I don't eat a lot of meat at home. I never really thought about it. But the things I loved and the things I craved were the things he only ate.
But what about that amazing steak that you make? Do you ever make it, or is it the end of your steak days?
You know, it's interesting. Right after I wrote my vegetarian cookbook, and I had been pretty strictly vegetarian for 2 solid years, I did a story on grass-fed beef. And I ended up being in the fields with these amazing, beautiful creatures, these gorgeous animals, the cows that had been just nursing their babies, and they were so human-like in their relationships. And I was so moved by it. But then, of course, the farmer gave me this incredible grass-fed beef. Of course, I took it home and cooked it right away. And my daughter, who was like 2 at the time, toddled out after her nap and sat down. And it was like, it was so innate for her. She just dug in, and I dug in with her, and we totally enjoyed it. It was amazing. So I still love it, you know, sometimes. So I think, you know, I think the whole idea that there's one way to eat or to say, I only do this ever, 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 kind of almost invites backlash. Whereas if you allow yourself your moments, you know, it's just like, you know, if you're a healthy eater, it doesn't mean you never eat a cupcake.
Right.
Right.
So for you, vegetarianism is expansive. It's what you do most of the time. But then there's also those moments. Now, what does your husband say when you break out the steak? Does he just kind of roll his eyes, or is he?
No, not at all. He's totally, you know, it's interesting because he's so comfortable in any setting. He's the guy that will never even tell you. He doesn't want anyone to do anything special for him. He doesn't want anyone to, like, work around it. And if we're guests at a week, you know, someone's weekend house, I bring eggs and I can make anything work. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I know exactly what you mean because my husband doesn't eat dairy. He'll eat butter, but not cream or cheese. So I use a lot less cheese in my cooking, but every time I eat cheese in front of him, it makes him really happy. He wants to see me enjoy
that. That's so sweet. I love it.
So we've been able to kind of negotiate a relationship around what he doesn't eat and what I love to eat, and somehow we all get fed.
Yeah, no, I think that's so great. It's really nice to acknowledge that other people really enjoy different things.
What about when you're cooking for your family? Do you find yourself using all kinds of different ingredients, maybe ingredients that are a little bit out of the ordinary?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I always joke that my husband's a vegetarian who doesn't really love vegetables. Like, he'll be like, are we having, oh gosh, kale again? Oh gosh, you know? Like, my whole philosophy around the way I cook, it's not about meat substitutes, it's about just delicious food. And so I think that opens up so many doors. And we have guests a lot at our house who have every different kind of dairy, gluten-free, vegetarian, or complete meat eaters. And I make things like artichoke enchiladas, which I'm making for friends this weekend. You know, it's all the familiar things, yummy tortilla, this juicy enchilada sauce. And inside is artichoke and quinoa. And it, by the way, happens to be gluten-free, which isn't my family's thing, but it works for other people. And it also happens to be vegetarian. But we never talk about it. We don't say, oh, you're coming over. Do you mind having vegetarian? That's what we eat at home. It's just like, oh, we're having mushroom goulash tonight, or we're having, you know, kale pizza or whatever. And everyone seems to be really happy. I will say that I often have a sliced charcuterie kind of somewhere present just in case someone's like really freaking out.
So you always have the meat just in case.
Right, right. It's like bacon, the gateway meat, they call it.
So when you were becoming a vegetarian cook, was there one ingredient that really opened up the vegetarian universe for you that you learned something from in particular?
Mushrooms kind of were my first aha because since my husband's Hungarian, and so I thought, how can I make goulash, this food that's so ingrained in his culture, in a way that everyone would just go nuts for it? And, you know, so that's a little obvious, but it actually, there's just so many ways to go with mushrooms.
And there's so many different kinds of mushrooms.
Right.
And they all have different flavors.
Exactly. And, you know, there's not a tremendous amount of prep. Of course, there's, you know, chopping and trimming and cleaning them. But it's not like tofu where if you really want to make it shine, you have to press it and season it so much. I mean, mushrooms have their own great flavor and they really marry with so many very quickly and easily.
And how do you boost flavors? Have you found one particular ingredient that you find yourself reaching for more than when you ate meat, like miso or soy sauce?
Miso would be a perfect one. I should use it more. And the thing for me is really like paprika paste or something like a red hot chili paste, which they have in so many different cultures. So you have it obviously in Hungarian, but you also have like an Italian or a Turkish red pepper paste, and you have chili paste in the Asian culture. So there's so many ways to use it. And one of the things that was really like a fear for me, because I love soup and we're a total soup family, was how to really pull off a really nourishing, exciting soup without chicken broth. Mm. And vegetable broth, I like, but it's kind of a lot of work to coax out like a really, a lot of umami or you can throw in Parmesan rind. There are things you can do. But I found that if I added paprika paste or red chili paste or anything to my broth, it just got this warm, you know, really earthy aroma and flavor that felt more satisfying than just, you know, say kind of a wimpy veggie broth.
It also gives it body.
Yeah, that's true. Exactly.
Thank you so much, Sarah. It was great talking to you.
Thanks for having me.
Chef Sarah Copeland is the author of Feast. Melissa Clark is a food columnist at the New York Times and author of Cook This Now. Well, Sarah left us with a recipe for a bottomless pot of bibimbap, and you can find it at splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. See you here next week. And in the meantime, let me leave you with this thought from Rita Mae Brown, who said, "Lead me not into temptation. I can find the way myself." Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. SplendidTable.org is your go-to source for great recipes, weekly newsletters, info about anything you heard here today, and podcasts. Head to our podcast network, InfiniteGuest.org, to download podcasts of The Splendid Table and others, including Dinner Party Download, a fast and funny hour serving up culture, food, and conversation with other winning elements for a stellar dinner party. Dinner Party Download at InfiniteGuest.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Laura Kalibi. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.